was agreed without division. Simon immediately returned home, and on arrival silently crept upstairs. He closed the bedroom door behind him and fumbled for the switch. The light by the side of the bed went on, and Elizabeth sat up. "Your cocoa's gone cold, and I've eaten all the biscuits," she said, grinning. "But thank you for leaving the radio on. At least I knew where you were." Chapter 26. Charles and Amanda were married at the most inconspicuous register office in Hammersmith. They then departed for a long weekend in Paris. Charles had told his bride that he preferred her not to let anyone learn of the marriage for at least another week. He didn't want Fiona to find yet a further excuse for not returning the Holbein. Amanda readily agreed, and then remembered. But surely Alec Pimpkin didn't count. Paris turned out to be fun, even though Charles was sensitive about Amanda's obvious pregnancy, never more so than when they arrived on the Friday night at the Plaza Athénée and were escorted to a suite overlooking the courtyard. Later, over dinner, Amanda astonished the waiters with her appetite, as well as the cut of her dress. Over breakfast in bed the next day, Charles read in the Herald Tribune that Mrs. Thatcher was considering a reshuffle that very weekend. He cut the honeymoon short and returned to London on the Saturday, 2 days earlier than planned. Amanda was not overjoyed. Her husband spent the whole of Sunday at Eaton Square alongside a phone that never rang. That same Sunday evening, the Prime Minister called for Simon Carslake and told him that he was to be made a Privy Councillor and would be moved from the Northern Ireland office to Defence as Minister of State. He had started to protest, but Mrs. Thatcher forestalled any discussion. "I don't want any more dead heroes, Simon," she said sharply. Elizabeth was relieved when she heard the news, although it took her some time to get used to her husband being referred to as the Right Honourable Simon Carslake. For some weeks, the old joke of rarely right and never honourable had to be suffered by both of them from countless well-meaning constituents who imagined they were the only people who had thought of the quip. Mrs. Thatcher called Charles Seymour on the Monday morning while he was waiting in Eaton Square for the return of the Holbein. Both sides' solicitors had agreed that the first Earl of Bridgewater should be back at Charles's home by 11 that morning. Only the Queen, or Mrs. Thatcher, could have kept Charles from being there to receive it. The Prime Minister's call came long after he thought the reshuffle was over, but then Mrs. Thatcher had been informed that Charles was in Paris on his honeymoon and wouldn't be back until the Monday morning. Charles took a taxi to Downing Street and was quickly ushered into the Prime Minister's study. Mrs. Thatcher began by complimenting him on the work he had carried out on successive finance bills in opposition and in government. She then invited him to join the front bench team as the financial secretary to the Treasury. Charles accepted gracefully, and after a short policy discussion with the Prime Minister, drove back to Eaton Square to celebrate both his triumphs. Amanda met him at the door to tell him that the Holbein had been returned. Fiona had kept her part of the bargain. The painting had been delivered at 11 o'clock sharp. Charles strode confidently into his drawing-room and was delighted to find the bulky package awaiting him. He was by no means so pleased to be followed by Amanda, a cigarette in one hand and a glass of gin in the other. But this was not a day for quarrels, he decided. He told her of his appointment, but she didn't seem to take in its significance until her husband opened a bottle of champagne. Charles poured out two glasses and handed one to his bride. "A double celebration. What fun," she said, first draining the gin. Charles took a quick sip of the champagne before he began to untie the knots and tear away the smart red wrapping paper that covered his masterpiece. Once the paper had been removed, he pulled back the final cardboard covers. Charles stared with delight at the portrait. The first Earl of Bridgewater was back home. Charles picked up the gold frame he knew so well to return it to its place in his study. But he noticed that the picture had come a little loose. "Damn," he said. "What's the matter?" asked Amanda, still leaning against the door. "Nothing important, and I shall have to get the frame fixed. I'll drop it into Oliver Swan on the way to the bank. I've waited nearly 3 years. Another couple of days won't make any difference." Now that Charles had accepted the post of financial secretary to the Treasury, he knew there was one little arrangement he had to clear up before the appointment became public knowledge. With that in mind, he left Eaton Square and dropped the Holbein off at the Framer. He then went on to the bank and summoned Clive Reynolds to his office. It was clear from Reynolds' manner that the news of Charles's ministerial appointment had not yet leaked out. "Clive," Charles called him for the first time, "I have a proposition to put to you." Clive Reynolds remained silent. "The Prime Minister has offered me a post in the government." "Congratulations," said Reynolds, "and well deserved, if I may say so." "Thank you," said Charles. "Now, I'm considering offering you the chance to stand in for me as chairman during my absence." Clive Reynolds looked surprised. "On the clear understanding that if the Conservatives were to return to opposition, or I were to lose my appointment in government, I would be reinstated as chairman immediately."
"Naturally," said Reynolds. "I should be delighted to fill the appointment for the interim period."
"Good man," said Charles. "It can't have escaped your notice what happened to the last chairman in the same situation."
"I shall make certain that will not happen again."
"Thank you," said Charles. "I shall not forget your loyalty when I return."
"And I shall also endeavour to carry on the traditions of the bank in your absence," said Reynolds, his head slightly bowed.
"I feel sure you will," said Charles.
The board accepted the recommendation that Clive Reynolds be appointed as temporary chairman, and Charles vacated his office, happily, to take up his new post at the Treasury. Charles considered it had been the most successful week of his life, and on the Friday evening, on the way back to Eaton Square, he dropped into Oliver Swan's gallery to pick up the Holbein.
"I'm afraid the picture didn't quite fit the frame," said Mr. Swan.
"Oh, I expect it's worked loose over the years," Charles said noncommittally.
"No, Mr. Seymour, this frame was put on the portrait quite recently," said Swan.
"That's not possible," said Charles. "I remember the frame as well as I remember the picture. The portrait of the first Earl of Bridgewater has been in my family for over 400 years.
"Not this picture," said Swan.
"What do you mean?"
said Charles, beginning to sound anxious.
"This picture came up for sale at Sotheby's about 3 weeks ago.
Charles went cold as Swan continued.
"It's the school of Holbein, of course," he said. "Probably painted by one of his pupils around the time of his death. I should think there are a dozen or so in existence."
"A dozen or so," repeated Charles, the blood drained from his face.
"Yes, perhaps even more. At least it's solved one mystery for me," said Swan, chuckling.
"What's that?" asked Charles, choking out the words.
"I couldn't work out why Lady Fiona was bidding for the picture, and then I remembered that your family name is Bridgewater."
"At least this wedding has some style,"
Pimpkin assured Fiona between mouthfuls of sandwich at the reception after her marriage to Alexander Dalgliesh. Pimpkin always accepted wedding invitations, as it allowed him to devour mounds of smoked salmon sandwiches and consume unlimited quantities of champagne.
"I particularly enjoyed that short service of blessing in the guards' chapel, and Claridge's can always be relied on to understand my little proclivities."
He peered round the vast room, and only stopped to stare at his reflection in a chandelier. Fiona laughed.
"Did you go to Charles's wedding?"
My darling, the only Etonians who have ever been seen in Hammersmith pass through it as quickly as possible on a boat representing either Oxford or Cambridge.
So you weren't invited, said Fiona.
I'm told that only Amanda was invited, and even she nearly found she had another engagement with her doctor, I believe.
Well, Charles certainly can't afford another divorce.
No, not in his present position as Her Majesty's financial secretary. One divorce might go unnoticed, but two would be considered habit-forming, and all diligent readers of Nigel Dempster have been able to observe that consummation has taken place.
But how long would Charles be able to tolerate her behaviour?
As long as he still believes she's given him a son who will inherit the family title. Not that a marriage ceremony will necessarily prove legitimacy,
added Pimpkin. Perhaps Amanda won't produce a son.
Perhaps. Whatever she produces, it will be obvious that it's not Charles's offspring,
said Pimpkin, falling into a chair that had been momentarily left by a large buxom lady. Even if it was, I can't see Amanda as a housewife.
No, but it suits Amanda's current circumstances to be thought of as the loving spouse.
Time may change that, too, said Fiona.
I doubt it, said Pimpkin. Amanda is stupid. That's been proven beyond reasonable doubt. But she has a survival instinct second only to a mongoose. So while Charles is spending all the hours of the day advancing his glittering career, she would be foolish to search publicly for greener pastures. Especially when she can always lie in them privately.
You're a wicked old gossip, said Fiona.
I cannot deny it, said Pimpkin, for it is an art at which women have never been as accomplished as men.
Thank you for such a sensible wedding present, said Alexander, joining his wife of 2 hours. You have selected my favourite claret.
Giving 12 bottles of the finest claret serves 2 purposes, said Pimpkin, his hands resting lightly on his stomach. First, you can always be assured of a decent wine when you invite yourself to dine.
And second? Asked Alexander.
When the happy couple split up, you can feel relieved that they'll no longer have your present to quarrel over.
Did you give Charles and Amanda a present? Asked Fiona.
No,
said Pimpkin, deftly removing another glass of champagne from a passing waiter.
I felt your return of the bogus Earl of Bridgewater was quite enough for both of us.
I wonder where he is now, said Alexander.
He no longer resides in Eaton Square, said Pimpkin,
with the air of one who has divulged a piece of information which can only guarantee further rapt attention. Who would want the phony Earl?
We're not aware of the provenance of the buyer, as he emanates from one of Her Majesty's former colonies, but the seller...
Stop teasing, Alec. Who?
None other than Mrs. Amanda Seymour.
Amanda?
Yes, Amanda, no less. The dear silly creature retrieved the false earl from the cellar where Charles had buried him with full military honours.
But she must have realised it was a fake.
My dear, Amanda wouldn't know the difference between a Holbein and an Andy Warhol, but she still happily accepted £10,000 for the impersonation. I'm assured that the dealer who purchased this fabricated masterpiece made what I think vulgar people in the city describe as a quick turn.
Good God, said Alexander. I only paid £8,000 for it myself.
Perhaps you should get Amanda to advise you on these matters in future, said Pimpkin. In exchange for my invaluable piece of information, I'm bound to inquire if the real Earl of Bridgewater is to remain in hiding.
Certainly not, Alec. He's merely awaiting the right moment to make a public appearance, said Fiona, unable to hide a smile. And where is Amanda now? Asked Alexander, obviously wanting to change the subject.
In Switzerland, producing a baby, which we can but hope will bear sufficient resemblance to a white Caucasian to convince one of Charles's limited imagination that he is the father.
Where do you get all your information from? Asked Alexander. Pimpkin sighed dramatically.
Women have a habit of pouring their hearts out to me, Amanda included.
Why should she do that? Asked Alexander.
She lives safe in the knowledge that I am the one man she knows who has no interest in her body.
Pimpkin drew breath, but only to devour another smoked salmon sandwich. Charles phoned Amanda every day while she was in Geneva. She kept assuring him all was well, and that the baby was expected on time. He had considered it prudent for Amanda not to remain in England advertising her pregnancy, a less than recent occurrence to even the most casual observer. She, for her part, did not complain. With £10,000 safely tucked away in a private Swiss account, there were few little necessities she could not have brought to her, even in Geneva. It had taken a few weeks for Charles to become accustomed to government after such a long break. He enjoyed the challenge of the Treasury, and quickly fell in with its strange traditions. He was constantly reminded that his was the department on which the Prime Minister kept the closest eye, making the challenge even greater. The civil servants, when asked their opinion of the new financial secretary, would reply variously. Able, competent, efficient, hard-working, but without any hint of affection in their voices. When someone asked his driver, whose name Charles could never remember, the same question, he proffered the view, "He's the sort of minister who always sits in the back of the car, but I'd still put a week's wages on Mr. Seymour becoming Prime Minister." Amanda produced her child in the middle of the ninth month. After a week's recuperation, she was allowed to return to England. She discovered travelling with her offspring was a nuisance, and by the time she had arrived at Heathrow, she was more than happy to turn the child over to the nanny Charles had selected. Charles had sent a car to pick her up from the airport. He had an unavoidable conference with a delegation of Japanese businessmen, he explained, all of them busy complaining about the new government tariffs on imports. At the first opportunity to be rid of his Oriental guests, he bolted back to Eaton Square. Amanda was there to meet him at the door. Charles had almost forgotten how beautiful his wife was and how long she had been away. "Where's my child?" he asked, after he had given her a long kiss. "In a nursery that's more expensively furnished than our bedroom," she replied a little sharply. Charles ran up the wide staircase and along the passage. Amanda followed. He entered the nursery and stopped in his tracks as he stared at the future Earl of Bridgewater. The little black curls and deep brown eyes came as something of a shock. "Good heavens," said Charles, stepping forward for a closer examination. Amanda remained by the door, her hand clutching its handle. She had 100 answers ready for his question.
"He's a spitting image of my great-grandfather. You skipped a couple of generations, Harry," said Charles, lifting the boy high into the air. "But there's no doubt you're a real Seymour."
Amanda sighed with inaudible relief. The 100 answers she could now keep to herself.
"It's more than a couple of generations the little bastards have skipped," said Pimpkin. "It's an entire continent."
He took another sip of christening champagne before continuing.
"This poor creature, on the other hand," he said, staring at Fiona's firstborn, "bears a striking resemblance to Alexander. Dear little girl should have been given a kinder legacy with which to start her life."
"She's beautiful," said Fiona, picking Lucy up from the cradle to check her nappy.
"Now we know why you needed to be married so quickly," added Pimpkin between gulps. "At least this child made wedlock, even if it was a close-run thing."
Fiona continued as if she'd not heard his remark. "Have you actually seen Charles's son?"
"I think we should refer to young Harry as Amanda's child," said Pimpkin. "We don't want to be had up under the Trade Descriptions Act."
"Come on, Alec. Have you seen Harry?" she asked, refusing to fill his empty glass.
"Yes, I have, and I'm afraid he also bears too striking a resemblance to his father for it to go unnoticed in later life.
Anyone we know? Asked Fiona, probing.
I'm not a scandalmonger, said Pimkin, removing a crumb from his waistcoat. As you well know, but a certain Brazilian fazendeiro who frequents Calvary Park and Ascot during the summer months has obviously maintained his interest in English fillies.
Pimkin confidently held out his glass. Chapter 27 James Callaghan's resignation as Labour Party leader in October 1980 took none of the political analysts by surprise. Unlike his predecessor, he was over 65, the age at which his party had recommended retirement. Those same analysts were surprised, however, when Michael Foote, the veteran left-winger, defeated Denis Healey by 139 votes to 129. To become the new leader of the Labour Party. The analysts immediately predicted a long spell of opposition for the Socialists. The Conservatives took much pleasure in watching a leadership struggle from the sidelines for a change. When Charles Seymour heard the result, it amused him that the Labour Party had ended up replacing a 60-year-old with a 64-year-old, who in turn was being replaced by a 67-year-old. Lord Shinwell, who at the age of 96 was the oldest living former Labour cabinet minister, declared that he would be a candidate for party leadership when Foote retired. When the election for the shadow cabinet came a week later, Andrew decided not to submit his name. Like many of his colleagues, he liked the new leader personally, but had rarely been able to agree with him on domestic issues and was totally opposed to his defence and European policies. Instead, he took on the chairmanship of the Select Committee on Scottish Affairs. Raymond, for his part, considered that Foote was destined to be no more than an interim leader, and was therefore quite happy to serve under him. When the election to the Shadow Cabinet was announced, Raymond came eighth. Michael Foote invited him to continue shadowing the trade portfolio. When Andrew entered the Commons chamber the day after the election, he walked up the gangway and took a seat on the back benches for the first time in 14 years. He looked down at Raymond, lounging on the front bench, and recalled his own words. There may well come a day when I sit and envy you from the same back benches. Andrew was not surprised when he heard from his local committee in Edinburgh that he would once again have to submit himself to re-selection as their candidate sometime during 1981. When the Labour conference the previous October had approved the mandatory re-selection of Labour MPs, he had realised his biggest battle would be internal. Frank Boyle had even managed to replace another of Andrew's supporters with one of his own henchmen. Roy Jenkins, the former deputy leader of the Labour Party, was returning from Brussels as soon as his term as president of the European Commission came to an end. After delivering the Dimbleby lecture on television, Jenkins made no secret of the fact that he was considering founding a new party that would take in those moderate radicals who felt the Labour Party had swung too far to the left. The party conference had removed the power of selection of the leaders from members of Parliament. For many, this was the final straw, and several Labour MPs told Jenkins they were ready to defect. Andrew would have preferred to remain loyal to the party and try to change it from the inside, but he was fast coming to the conclusion that that hour had passed. In his morning mail was a curt note from the constituency secretary informing him that Frank Boyle was going to oppose him for the nomination. Andrew flew up to Edinburgh on the day of the meeting, fearing the worst. No one met him at the airport, and at party headquarters, David Connaught greeted him with a glum face. Andrew stood in front of the committee in a cold, cheerless room, and answered the same questions that had been put to him only 3 years before. He gave exactly the same answers. Where he stood on nuclear disarmament. Why he was in favour of a close association with the United States. his attitude to a wealth tax. On and on. Predictable question after predictable question. But he never once allowed them to exasperate him. He ended with the words, "I've been proud to serve the people of Edinburgh Carlton for almost 20 years as the Labour member, and hope to do so for at least another 20. If you now feel unable to re-select me, I would have to consider standing as an independent candidate." For the first time, one or two members of the committee looked anxious.
"We're not intimidated by your threats, Mr. Fraser," said Frank Boyle. "The Labour Party has always been bigger than any individual. Now we know where Mr. Fraser's real interests lie, I suggest we move to a vote."
12 little slips of paper were passed out. Fraser or Boyle were scribbled on them before they were sent back to the chairman. Frank Boyle slowly gathered up the slips, clearly relishing Andrew's discomfort. He unfolded the first slip of paper.
"Boyle," he said, glancing at the others round the table.
He opened a second.
"Fraser,"
then a third.
"Boyle,"
followed by "Fraser, Fraser, Fraser." Andrew kept count in his head. 4-2 in his favour. "Fraser," followed by "Boyle, Boyle, Fraser." 6-4 in Andrew's favour, with 2 still unopened. He only needed 1 more vote.
"Boyle."
6-5. The chairman took some considerable time opening the last slip.
"Boyle,"
he announced in triumph. He paused for effect.
6 votes all,
he declared.
"Under Standing Order 42 of the party constitution,"
he said, as if he had learned the words off by heart before the meeting,
"and the result of a tie, the chairman shall have the casting vote."
He paused once again.
"Boyle,"
he said, lingering for a moment.
"I therefore declare that Frank Boyle is selected as the official Labour Party candidate for the constituency of Edinburgh Carlton at the next general election."
He turned to Andrew and said,
"We shall no longer be requiring your services, Mr. Fraser."
"I would like to thank those of you who supported me," Andrew said quietly, and left without another word. The next day, the Scotsman came out with a lengthy article on the dangers of a small group of willful people having the power to remove a member who had served his constituents honourably over a long period of time. Andrew phoned Stuart Gray to thank him. "I only wish the article had come out the day before," he said.
"It was set up for yesterday," Stuart told him, "but the announcement from Buckingham Palace of Prince Charles's engagement to Lady Diana Spencer moved everything else out, even the Rangers Celtic report. By the way, doesn't Boyle's nomination have to be confirmed by his general management committee?"
"Yes, but they're putty in his hands.
That would be like trying to explain to your mother-in-law about your wife's nagging."
"Then why don't you appeal to the National Executive and ask for the decision to be put to a full meeting of the constituency party?"
"Because it would take weeks to get the decision overturned. And more importantly, I'm no longer certain that I want to fight the seat as a Labour candidate."
Andrew listened to the reporter's question and said, "Yes, you may quote me." As the date for an election grew nearer, Charles decided it might be wise to introduce Amanda to the constituency. He'd explained to those who inquired that his wife had had a rather bad time of it after the birth, and had been told by her doctors not to participate in anything that might raise her blood pressure, though one or two constituents considered that the Sussex Downs Conservatives would find it hard to raise the blood pressure of a 90-year-old with a pacemaker. Charles had also decided to leave Harry at home, explaining that it was he who had chosen a public life, not his son. The annual garden party, held in the grounds of Lord Cookfield's country home, seemed to Charles to be the ideal opportunity to show off Amanda, and he asked her to be certain to wear something appropriate. He was aware that designer jeans had come into fashion, and that his clothes-conscious wife never seemed to dress in the same thing twice. He also knew that liberated women didn't wear bras. But he was, nevertheless, shocked when he saw Amanda in a near see-through blouse and jeans so tight it looked as if she'd been poured into them. Charles was genuinely horrified.
"Can't you find something a little more conservative?" he suggested. "Like the things that old Frump Fiona used to wear?"
Charles couldn't think of a suitable reply.
"The garden party will be frightfully dull," said Charles desperately. "Perhaps I should go on my own."
Amanda turned and looked him in the eye.
"Are you ashamed of me, Charlie?"
He drove his wife silently down to the constituency, and every time he glanced over at her, he wanted to make an excuse to turn back. When they arrived at Lord Cookfield's home, his worst fears were confirmed. Neither the men nor the women could take their eyes off Amanda as she strolled around the lawns devouring strawberries. Many of them would have used the word hussy if she hadn't been the member's wife. Charles might have escaped lightly had it only been the one risque joke Amanda told to the bishop's wife, or even her curt refusals to judge the baby contest or draw the raffle. But he was not to be so lucky. The chairman of the Women's Advisory Committee had met her match when she was introduced to the member's wife.
"Darling," said Charles, "I don't think you've met Mrs. Blenkinsop."
"No, I haven't," said Amanda,
ignoring Mrs. Blenkinsop's outstretched hand.
"Mrs. Blenkinsop," continued Charles, "was awarded the OBE for her services to the constituency."
"OBE?"
Amanda asked innocently. Mrs. Blenkinsop drew herself up to her full height.
"Order of the British Empire," she said.
"I've always wondered," said Amanda, smiling. "My dad used to tell me it stood for Other Bugger's Efforts."
"Seen the Purcell anywhere?" asked Louise.
"No, I stopped washing my own pants some time ago," replied Andrew.
"Ha, ha," said Louise. "But if you haven't taken them, who has? Two giant packets are missing."
"The phantom Purcell thief strikes again. Whatever next?" said Andrew.
"The Bovril, perhaps." "Stop making a fool of yourself and go and fish Clarissa out of the bath."
Andrew pulled himself out of the armchair, dropped the Economist on the carpet, and ran upstairs. "Time to get out, young lady," he said, even before he reached the bathroom door.
First, he heard the sobbing. Then, when he opened the door, he found Clarissa covered from head to toe in soap flakes. Her thick black curly hair was matted with them. Andrew burst out laughing, but he stopped when he saw Clarissa's knees and shins were bleeding. She held a large scrubbing brush in one hand, which was covered in a mixture of soap powder and blood.
"What's the matter, darling?" asked Andrew, kneeling on the bath mat.
"It isn't true,"
said Clarissa, not looking at him.
"What isn't true?" asked Andrew gently.
"Look on the box," she said, pointing at the two empty packets which were standing on the end of the bath.
Andrew glanced at the familiar picture on the box of a little fair-haired girl in a white party dress.
"What isn't true?"
he repeated, still uncertain what Clarissa meant.
"It isn't true that Purcell washes whiter. Two large packets and I'm still black," she said.
Andrew had to smile, which only made Clarissa cry even more. After he'd washed off all the suds and gently dried her, he put antiseptic ointment on the cuts and bruises.
"Why am I so black?" she asked.
"Because your mother and father were black," replied Andrew, guiding his daughter through to her bedroom.
"Why can't you be my father? Then I'd be white."
"I am your father now, so you don't need to be."
Yes, I do.
Why?
Because the children at school laugh at me,
Clarissa said, clutching firmly onto Andrew's hand. When I was at school, they used to laugh at me because I was small, said Andrew. They called me puny.
What did you do about it?
Asked Clarissa. I trained hard and ended up as captain of the school rugby team, and that made them stop laughing.
But by then you were big. I can't train to be white.
No, I was still small, and you won't need to train.
Why?
Asked Clarissa, still not letting go of his hand. Because you're going to be beautiful, and then all those ugly white girls will be, oh, so jealous. Clarissa was silent for some time before she spoke again.
Promise, Daddy.
I promise, he said, remaining on the edge of the bed.
Like Frank Boyle is jealous of you.
Andrew was startled. What do you know about him?
Only what I heard Mummy say, that he's going to be the Labour man for Edinburgh, but you'll still beat him.
Andrew was speechless.
Is he going to be the Labour man, Daddy?
She asked. Yes, he is.
And will you beat him?
I'll try.
Can I help?
Clarissa asked, a tiny smile appearing on her face. Of course. Now off you go to sleep, said Andrew, getting up and drawing the curtains.
Is he black?
Who? Asked Andrew.
A nasty Frank Boyle.
No, said Andrew, laughing. He's white.
Then he ought to be made to have my skin. Then I could have his.
Andrew turned off the light. Relieved, Clarissa could no longer see his face.
This ends side two of cassette 8 of First Among Equals. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 9. First Among Equals, cassette 9.
Harry's second birthday party was attended by all those two-year-olds in the vicinity of Eaton Square, whom his nanny considered acceptable. Charles managed to escape from the departmental meeting, accompanied by a large paintboard and a red tricycle. As he parked his car in Eaton Square, he spotted Fiona's old Volvo driving away towards Sloane Square. He dismissed the coincidence, although he still had plans for regaining the priceless Holbein. Harry naturally wanted to ride the tricycle round and round the dining room table. Charles sat watching his son and couldn't help noticing that he was smaller than most of his friends. Then he remembered that great-grandfather had only been 5 feet 8 inches tall. It was the moment after the candles had been blown out and Nanny switched the light back on that Charles was first aware that something was missing. It was like the game children play with objects on a tray. Everyone shuts his eyes, Nanny takes one away, and then you all have to guess which piece it was. It took Charles some time to realize that the missing object was his gold cigar box. He walked over to the sideboard and studied the empty space. He continued to stare at the spot where the small gold box left him by his great-grandfather had been the previous night. Now all that was left in its place was the matching lighter. He immediately asked Amanda if she knew where the heirloom was, but his wife seemed totally absorbed in lining up the children for a game of musical chairs. After checking carefully in the other room, Charles went into his study and phoned the Chelsea police. An inspector from the crime squad came round immediately and took down all the details. Charles was able to supply the police officer with a photograph of the box, which carried the initials CGS. He stopped just short of mentioning Fiona by name. The inspector assured Charles that he would deal with the investigation personally. Charles returned to the party,
to find nannies arriving to gather their wards. When the Edinburgh Carlton Labour Party issued a press statement after their AGM, announcing that Frank Boyle had been selected to fight the seat as their candidate, Andrew was surprised and touched by the flood of letters and calls of goodwill he received, many from people he didn't even know. Most of the messages begged him to stand at the next general election as an independent. 20 Labour MPs and one Conservative had joined the newly formed Social Democratic Party, and many others were expected to follow. Andrew knew he would have to make an announcement soon if he didn't want his supporters to drift away. He spent agonizing hours discussing with Louise the problem of severing the final bonds with the party. "What shall I do?" he asked yet again. "I can't tell you that. I just hope you make up your mind fairly quickly." "Why quickly?" "Because I'm going to vote for the Social Democrats at the next election, so you'd better be my local candidate." A few days later, Roy Jenkins, Andrew's old chief at the Home Office, phoned to say he was fighting a by-election in Glasgow as the SDP candidate. "I do hope you'll feel able to join us," said Jenkins. Andrew had always admired Jenkins' firm stand against the left, and felt he was the one man who might break the two-party system. "I need a little more time," he replied. A week later, Andrew made up his mind and informed the chief whip that he was leaving the party and would be joining the SDP. Then he packed a bag and travelled to Glasgow. Roy Jenkins won the seat at Glasgow Hill Head with a large enough swing to worry both main parties. By Easter, a total of 29 members of Parliament had broken away to join him, while the alliance of SDP and Liberal MPs together could muster more than 40 votes on the floor of the House. With opinion polls putting them in second place, it began to look possible that the Social Democrats might hold the balance of power after the next election. The Conservatives were now running a poor third in all the national opinion polls. Charles heard nothing for 3 weeks about the missing gold box, and was beginning to despair when the inspector phoned to say that the family heirloom had been found.
"Excellent news," said Charles. "Are you able to bring the box round to Eaton Square?"
"It's not quite as simple as that, sir," said the policeman.
"What do you mean?"
"I would prefer not to discuss the matter over the phone. May I come and see you, sir?"
"By all means," said Charles, slightly mystified.
He waited impatiently for the inspector to arrive, although the policeman was at the front door barely 10 minutes later. His first question took Charles by surprise.
"Are we alone, sir?"
"Yes," said Charles.
"My wife and son are away visiting my mother-in-law in Wales."
"You say you found the gold box?" he continued, impatient to hear the inspector's news.
"Yes, sir."
"Well done, Inspector. I shall speak to the Commissioner personally," he added, guiding the officer towards the drawing-room.
"I'm afraid there's a complication, sir."
"How can there be when you found the box?"
"We can't be sure there was anything illegal about its disappearance in the first place."
"What do you mean, Inspector?"
"The gold case was offered to a dealer in Grafton Street for £2,500.
"And who was doing the selling?" asked Charles impatiently.
"That's the problem, sir. The cheque was made out to Amanda Seymour, and the description fits your wife," said the inspector.
Charles was speechless.
"And the dealer has a receipt to prove the transaction."
The inspector passed over a copy of the receipt. Charles was unable to steady his shaking hand as he recognized Amanda's signature. "Now, as this matter has already been referred to the Director of Public Prosecutions, I thought I ought to have a word with you in private, as I'm sure you wouldn't want us to prefer charges."
"Yes, No, of course. Thank you for your consideration, Inspector, said Charles flatly. Not at all, sir. The dealer has made his position clear. He would be only too happy to return the cigar box for the exact sum he paid for it. I don't think that could be fairer. Charles made no comment other than to thank the inspector again before showing him out. He returned to his study, phoned Amanda at her mother's house, and told her to return immediately. She started to protest, but he had already hung up. Charles remained at home until they all arrived back at Eaton Square late that night. The nanny and Harry were immediately sent upstairs. It took Charles about 5 minutes to discover that only a few £100s of the money was left. When his wife burst into tears, he struck her across the face with such force that she fell to the ground. "If anything else goes missing from this house," he said, "you will go with it, and I will also make sure you spend a very long time in jail." Amanda ran out of the room, sobbing uncontrollably. The next day, Charles advertised for a full-time governess. He also moved his own bedroom to the top floor so that he could be close to his son. Amanda made no protest. Once the governess had settled in, Amanda quickly became bored with the child and began disappearing for long periods. Charles couldn't be sure where she was most of the time and didn't care. After Pemkin had recounted the latest state of affairs to Alexander Dalgleish in well-embroidered detail, Fiona remarked to her husband, "I never thought the day would come when I would feel sorry for Charles." On a sleepy Thursday in April 1982, Argentina attacked and occupied two small islands whose 1,800 British citizens were forced to lower the Union Jack for the first time in over 100 years. Few members returned to their constituency that Friday, and the House met unusually on a Saturday morning to debate the crisis while the nation followed every word on the radio. The same day, Mrs. Thatcher immediately dispatched a task force halfway around the globe to recapture the islands. Her fellow countrymen followed every scrap of news so intently that the London theatres found themselves empty at the height of the season. Simon felt exhilarated to be a member of the defence team at such a historic moment, and Elizabeth didn't begrudge him those days when he left before she had woken and arrived home after she had fallen asleep. Under less public scrutiny, but almost equal pressure, Charles beavered away at the Treasury, addressing the economic problems that had been presented. He spent day after day in the House, helping to put the government's case. Like Simon, he found he could only snatch moments to be at home. But, unlike Elizabeth, his wife remained in bed until midday. When Charles did manage to slip away from the department, he spent all his time with Harry, whose progress he followed with delighted concern. At the time when the Union Jack was raised once again in the Falklands, the budget became an act.
Chapter 28. PM to go in November, and will Maggie wait till June, were two of the headlines Andrew read on the first day of the new parliamentary session. Anyone who is defending a marginal seat is always on edge as the statutory 5 years draws to a close, and the new SDP members all treated their seats as marginal. Andrew was no exception. He had worked hard to prove he was worth his place in the group the leader of the Social Democrats was beginning to form in the Commons. When Roy Jenkins had announced the makeup of his shadow team, Andrew was appointed defence spokesman, and enjoyed the challenge of pitting himself against the two main parties in the Commons in the run-up to the election. But once the Falklands crisis was over, he knew his real problems were not going to be in Westminster, but in Edinburgh, where he spent an increasing amount of his time. Hamish Ramsay phoned to ask him if there was anything he could do to help. "Be my chairman for the election campaign," said Andrew simply. Ramsay agreed without hesitation, and within a fortnight, four members of Andrew's old Labour Party committee had defected to join him. Support for Andrew came from the most surprising quarters, including Jock McPherson, who pledged the Scottish Nationalists would not be contesting the Edinburgh Carlton seat, as they had no desire to see Frank Boyle in Parliament. Sir Duncan Fraser kept very quiet about what the Conservatives were up to until they announced that Jamie Lomax would be their standard-bearer. Lomax? Lomax? Repeated Andrew. He and I were at school together, he told his father. He was known as Loopy Lomax. You've selected the biggest idiot of his generation.
That's a disgraceful slur on an able man, said Sir Duncan, trying to keep a straight face. I can assure you it took a lot of convincing the committee to make certain Lomax was selected.
How did you fix it?
I must admit it wasn't easy. We had some very good applicants, but I managed to undermine every one of them and point out how blemish-free Lomax's political past was, said Sir Duncan, winking.
Non-existent careers make for the best blemish-free pasts, said Andrew, and burst out laughing.
Yes, I'm afraid one or two of the committee noticed that. But you must admit Lomax is a fine figure of a man, added his father.
What's that got to do with it? Asked Andrew. You weren't looking for a male model as candidate.
No, but it did help me to swing the ladies on the Women's Advisory Committee round to my way of thinking.
You're a rogue, father.
No, I'm not. There isn't a Conservative in Scotland who would rather see Frank Boyle in the House than you. And as we have no chance of winning the seat, why let him in?
Louise and Clarissa spent the Christmas recess in Edinburgh. Sir Duncan warned Louise that if Andrew lost this election, he could never hope to return to the House of Commons again. During 1983, Margaret Thatcher stuck firm to her monetarist policies and brought inflation below 4%, while in parts of Scotland, unemployment rose to 15%. She had gradually stifled any opposition from the Wets, and by the end of her first administration, they were totally outmaneuvered. But it was the outcome of the Falklands crisis that had kept her ahead in the opinion polls for over a year. The press speculated on the date of the general election all through the month of April, and after the Conservatives' success in the local elections on the 5th of May, the Prime Minister sought an audience with the Queen. Shortly afterwards, Margaret Thatcher told the nation that she needed another 5 years to continue her policies and prove that they worked. The election date was set for the 9th of June. Once the election campaign had begun in earnest, Stuart Gray interviewed all three candidates on behalf of the Scotsman and told Andrew he had a plan to help him. You can't, said Andrew. You're bound to remain neutral and give all three candidates equal column inches during the campaign. Agreed, said Stuart. But on the one hand, we know Frank Boyle is sharp and has the looks of an escaped convict, while Jamie Lomax looks like a film star but makes crass statements every time he opens his mouth. So, said Andrew. So I'm going to cover the political pages with the worst shots I can find of Boyle and fill up inch after inch with the sayings of Lomax. They'll both get equal coverage, while at the same time they'll lose votes.
They'll suss it out and complain to the editor.
I doubt it, said Stuart. I have yet to meet a politician who complained about having his photo in the paper, or one who was angered by seeing his mad views aired to a larger audience than he could have hoped to influence in the past.
And what do you propose to do about me?
That's a problem, admitted Stuart, laughing. Perhaps I'll leave the columns blank. That's one way you can't lose votes. Whenever Andrew carried out a door-to-door canvass, he found a clear division between those who still backed him and those who thought he had been disloyal to the Labour Party. As the canvass returns came in and the colours were put out on the trestle tables in the new party headquarters, it became clear from even a cursory glance that it was going to be his toughest election yet. Andrew had experienced some dirty campaigns over the years,
especially when he'd been up against the Scottish Nationalists. But after only a few days, he had sweet memories of Jock McPherson, who was Little Red Riding Hood compared with Boyle. Andrew could just about tolerate hearing that he'd been thrown out of the Labour Party because he was such a lazy member, even that he had left them in the lurch because he'd been told he could never hope to be a minister again. But when it was repeated to him that the Boyle camp was spreading a rumour that Louise had lost her voice because, when she had her baby, it turned out to be black, he was furious. If Andrew had seen Boyle that day, he would undoubtedly have hit him. Sir Duncan counselled restraint, pointing out that any other action could only harm Louise and Clarissa. Andrew took a deep breath and said nothing. With a week to go, a local opinion poll in the Scotsman showed Boyle leading by 35% to Andrew's 32%. The Conservatives had 19%, but 14% remained undecided. Jock McPherson had kept his word. No Scottish Nationalist candidate had entered the lists. On the Friday before the election, McPherson went one better by issuing a statement advising his supporters to back Andrew Fraser. When Andrew phoned to thank him, he said, "I'm returning a favour." "I don't remember ever doing you a favour," said Andrew. "You certainly did, remembering you're an Edinburgh man. One mention to the press of my offer of the leadership of the Scottish Nationalists, and I'd have been sunk down the nearest pothole." With 5 days to go, Alliance supporters from the two Edinburgh constituencies, which were not fielding an SDP candidate, swarmed in to help Andrew, and he began to believe the canvass returns that were now showing he could win. With 2 days to go, the Scotsman proclaimed it was 39% to 38% in Boyle's favour, but also went on to point out that the Labour Party would have a better oiled machine to depend on when it came to polling day. In his eve of poll message, Andrew issued a clear statement on why his views differed from those of his opponent in the Labour Party, and how he saw the future of Britain if the Alliance gained enough seats to hold the balance of power. He reminded voters that without exception, the national opinion polls showed the SDP now running neck and neck with Labour. Frank Boyle also put out an eve of poll message, delivered to every house in the constituency, showing a picture of Andrew holding Clarissa in his arms under the caption, "Does your member tell you the whole truth?" There was no mention of Louise or Clarissa in the text, but the innuendo could not have been clearer. Andrew didn't see the sheet until the morning of polling day, by which time he knew there was nothing effective he could do to refute Boyle's implied slur. Issuing a writ that could not be dealt with until weeks after the election was over could only prove impotent. He either won the day, or he lost it. To that end, he and Louise never stopped working from 7 that morning until 10 at night. Helpers arrived from the most unexpected places, as if to prove the Scotsman wrong about the Labour Party machine. But Andrew couldn't help noticing that there were red rosettes everywhere he went. Towards the end of the day, even Sir Duncan joined him and began chauffeuring SDP voters to the polls in his Rolls Royce.
"We've faced the fact that our candidate has lost, so now I've come to help you," he told Andrew bluntly.
As the City Hall clock struck 10, Andrew sat down on the steps of the last polling station. He knew there was nothing he could do now. He had done everything possible, only avoiding members of the House of Lords and lunatics, neither of which group was entitled to vote. An old lady was coming out of the polling station with a smile on her face.
"Hello, Mrs. Bloxham," said Andrew. "How are you?"
"I'm fine, Andrew," she smiled. "I nearly forgot to vote, and that would have never done."
He raised his tired head.
"Now don't fret yourself, laddie," she continued. "I never failed to vote for the winner in 52 years, and that's longer than you've lived."
She chuckled and left him sitting on the steps. Andrew somehow picked himself up and made his way through the dark, cobbled streets to his election headquarters. They cheered him as he entered the room, and the chairman offered him a wee dram of whiskey.
"To hell with a wee dram," said Andrew. "Just keep polling."
He tried to get round the room to thank everyone before Hamish Ramsay told him it was time to go over to the City Hall for the Count. A small band of supporters accompanied the Frasers to the City Hall to witness the proceedings. As he entered the hall,